All right, welcome to Indie Media On Air. We have a very special show for you today. We're going to be talking with Edward Herman. But before we get into the show, Alice Taylor is going to read us the Indie Media headlines.
From LA Indie Media, Los Angeles reclaiming May Day. Recognizing May Day as their Labor Day, thousands of American and immigrant workers marched on Saturday and Sunday in the streets of several cities all across the U.S. In New York, after protests from labor activists and threats of legal suits against the city, Mayor Bloomberg finally issued a permit to march. Here in LA, the large immigrant population made this Southern California event the biggest of its kind in the nation. Unlike in the U.S., May Day is a major event, even a national holiday in many countries, but especially south of the U.S. border in Mexico, Central America, South America, and also in Europe. In other parts of the world, thousands of workers celebrate the world-changing 1886 strike that brought to us the 8-hour day and better working conditions. For more on this story, visit laindiemedia.org. Also this month, in honor of May Day, Critical Mass Radio Network, a decentralized international radio network composed of independent community radio stations, will be broadcasting shows on labor movements. August Sound Coalition, New York's link in the CMRN network, will be featuring interviews with the May 1st Technology Collective, a workers' collective providing tech support to community groups, and the editors of Spread, a new magazine by and about sex works and their working lives. For the schedule of interviews, visit indiemedia.us. And from indiemedia.org, nonviolent peace demonstration becomes a war zone in Palestine. Over the past 2 years, the popular nonviolent resistant movement against the construction of the separation wall on Palestinian lands has been growing, establishing grounds for Palestinian-Israeli international grassroots popular cooperation. Village after village along the route of the wall has risen to nonviolently protest the construction, which separates people from their lands and creates conditions for forced transfer and internal displacement. Solidarity, although constantly proclaimed, is very difficult to realize as the Israeli army restricts freedom of movement from village to village. The last focal place of protests is in the village of Bilin, where last week a nonviolent protest of the whole village population with the support of Israeli and international peace activists encountered armed response. And lastly, from indiemedia.org, Coca-Cola sucking India dry. The people of Plashimadya in southern India rallied together on Friday, April 22nd for the third anniversary of the Plashimada Coca-Cola plant, an accompanying three-year, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week protest vigil outside its gates to publicly show its opposition to the corporation's existing and planned environmental degradation in the area. This has been the most recent of ongoing opposition to Coca-Cola's unethical conduct in India, where they have been alleged to have caused several water shortages, water and land pollution, the distribution of toxic waste as fertilizer, and for sale the drinks containing high levels of pesticides. Coca-Cola is further negligent, as it has not reported any of the damages it has made and continues operations. Tens of thousands of community members have been participating in an international campaign to hold Coca-Cola accountable for its conduct. With increased resistance, community members demand that plants in several parts of India be shut down. Now stay tuned for Indie Media On Air with Chris Burnett in an interview with Edward Herman.
All right, welcome back to Indie Media On Air. That was Hot Snakes, top of the hour. We had Plenty for All. That was a title track. And I'm really pleased to announce that today we'll be talking with Edward Herman. Edward Herman is Professor Emeritus at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, regular contributor to Z Magazine, an economist, and a media critic. He is the author of numerous books, including The Myth of the Liberal Media, The Real Terror Network, and the classic Manufacturing Consent, co-written with Noam Chomsky. Edward Herman, welcome to Indie Media On Air.
Glad to be here with you, Chris.
Well, this past Friday, there was a protest against the most recent New York Times executive editor, Bill Keller. And it was in regards to the paper's record in the run-up to the Iraq War. And although Keller was not the executive editor in the run-up to the war, Keller has defended the paper's record both before and after. And first question I have for you is, why is Bill Keller someone that we should be concerned about?
Well, just because he's a power in the New York Times, and he has, I mean, he was elevated to that position. And interestingly enough, I don't know if this came out in the talks and discussions with him, but he was a firm, passionate supporter of going to war with Iraq. And having done that and having sort of bombed in his reporting on that subject, he then gets elevated to managing editor. That tells us something. It's sort of like the Bush administration pushing some of its failed creatures up to high office.
Yeah, in fact, I have a quote here from a Norman Solomon article in which Keller says, "The truth is that the information-gathering machine designed to guide our leaders in matters of war and peace shows signs of being corrupted. To my mind, this is a worrisome problem, but not because it invalidates the war we won. It is a problem because it weakens us for the wars we still face."
Boy, that's an amazing statement. It doesn't invalidate us for the war we're in. Well, it tells us that we got into the war on false pretenses, and that would seem to invalidate it all from the word go. We allegedly went in to get to end that imminent threat that Saddam Hussein presented to us, and here the guy tells us, well, that maybe that was completely invalid, but the invasion was not invalidated. That's really droll.
Yeah, it's pretty stark.
Yeah, he and the Times, incidentally, have never, I don't believe ever, in their editorials mention that there's a thing called the UN Charter that makes an invasion of a sovereign country a violation of the Charter, therefore a violation of international law, and a violation of the U.S. Constitution, because the UN Charter law is part of U.S. law, part of the Constitution. The violation of international law of a gross sort, and the Times has never yet mentioned it. And of course, we went in under false pretenses, and we're violating international law. That doesn't invalidate it for Bill Keller. It tells you where he is.
Yeah, no doubt. Here's a quote I'd like you to comment on. He said, "I wish the press had been able to do before the war what a series of post-war inspections and commissions has done since then. But it's not clear to me how reporters who do not have the power of subpoena, who do not have superior intelligence, could have accomplished that before the war."
That's a deeply dishonest statement, because the New York Times has a lot of resources. It could talk to people other than Shalabi and other hacks who are presented to them by the administration. Interesting example, there's a man named Hussein Kamel. Do you know that name?
No.
Hussein Kamel? He was the son-in-law of Saddam Hussein, and he defected. He was in charge of their chemical biological warfare program. He defected, brought with him boxes of documents, and was interviewed by the CIA. This was in 1995. And at that time, this man who had defected said that Saddam Hussein's chemical and biological weapons had been totally wiped out in 1991-92. They still had some, microfiches and some plans, but the weapons themselves had been completely wiped out. This was finally revealed by Newsweek a couple of years ago, but the New York Times has never yet reported that story. They've never gone to talk. They never went to talk to him before he went back to Iraq to be killed. So, there were an enormous number of sources that the New York Times did not tap. For example, Scott Ritter, who was a high-level arms inspector, was available to talk to. The New York Times never had him. They never had Hans von Sponeck, another high-level UN person on the scene working in this field. Instead, they get Kenneth Pollack, who had four op-ed columns, to claim that that Saddam Hussein was a real imminent threat. But no Scott, not Scott Ritter, not von Sponeck, not Kamal Hussein, not Glenn Rangwala. Glenn Rangwala is a Cambridge physicist who has written a lot of very good stuff analyzing sources and the basis for the claims of weapons of mass destruction, never in the New York Times. And even maybe even more important, the International Atomic Energy Commission had, I think, 60 reports on Saddam Hussein's atomic weapons capability between 91 and 93, a couple of them in 92, 93. They all were claiming that there's no evidence that Saddam Hussein has a nuclear capability. They were either not cited, or when they were cited, they were miscited. And there's quite a nice book written by Howard Friel and Richard Falk called The Record of the Paper, How the New York Times Misreports U.S. Foreign Policy. And in its chapters 1 and 2, they actually go through the New York Times editorials and how they reported on this stuff. And they point out that they had at least 14 editorials in which they claim, or they assume, they just assume that it's been proven that Saddam Hussein has the weapons of mass destruction. They just take it, since the administration said it was so, they just take it as a given. And they have one editorial where they're very stern about the fact that Saddam Hussein and the Iraqis have not given definitive proof that they don't have these things. They haven't proven the negative, and they're very stern on that. But with respect to what the administration has to cough up, they don't insist on any facts, evidence, or anything, and they don't go to the International Atomic Energy Commission reports, and they don't examine what those reports say in detail. When they do talk about them, as this book points out, they twist them around. They feature the few uncertainties and not the claims that essentially those programs are dead. So what he has said is really a big lie. There were lots of sources. They'd refused to tap them. And they have a stream of editorials that assumed what the administration says is true. So, and we're dealing with a big lie. Yeah. They were a war propaganda agency.
I want to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Edward Herman, who is Professor Emeritus at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania and a regular contributor to Z Magazine, an economist and a media critic, among the author of many books, including The Myth of Liberal Media, The Real Terror Network, and The Classic Manufacturing Consent, co-written with Noam Chomsky. Edward, I'm really glad that you went through the sources, because I have a quote, the sources that would have given the New York Times more of a sense of reality about the WMDs, because right after the protest at Pomona College on Friday, there was a question and answer session, and in that session he was quoted as saying, "The fact is that the belief that Iraq had illegal weapons of mass destruction was not created by the Bush administration or something concocted by the press. It was the nearly universal belief of the Clinton administration, the Democrats in Congress, of American and foreign intelligence agencies, of UN weapons inspectors, of the UN Security Council. A lot of evidence now suggests they were just wrong, but that belief was not entirely a concoction of the hawks in the Bush administration."
Well, there are lies in there, because it was not certainly a belief of everybody in the intelligence community, and certainly the agencies, like the International Atomic Energy Agency, was giving a contrary view that the New York Times refused to acknowledge. And, of course, there were these people like Scott Ritter, who was there up to 1998 and who still had contacts, who was a marvelous source, far better than Kenneth Pollack. Ritter is not available. Anyway, there's a lot of lying there. That's still... There was a forced consensus that was forced by the administration. And this whole business of what the intelligence agency said, you know, and what a lot of political leaders believe, a lot of this ignores the fact that this administration is incredibly aggressive and forces its opinion. Cheney going over to the CIA multiple times to straighten them out. eventually these people learn that we, meaning the Bush administration, want a certain line. We want a certain truth. And so that truth, I'm totally convinced that the truth was doctored because of pressures and the recognition that their future was at stake if they did not come up with what the Bush administration wanted. But apart from that, there was a lot of dissent, and a lot of the things that they claim, like the Niger uranium, the aluminum tubes that were supposed to be nuclear weapons capable. There's a lot of evidence that there was internal dissent on that within the intelligence community. So he's trying to rationalize an unconscionable cover-up. The Times performed outrageously. They did not use sources that were inconvenient to the line that the editors were pushing hard, including Keller himself. The will to believe there was important.
Right. Edward, in your book, The Myth of the Liberal Media, you have two chapters related to the Times, the New York Times.
Yeah.
And in one, you discuss the structure of the Times and its relationship to power and government policy. Does the New York Times as an institution serve the long-term interests of U.S. policy?
Oh, well, that goes almost without saying, because it's an establishment institution, in fact.
Well, what about the structure? What should we know about it? How does it function?
Well, it's a stock-owned company. It has a board of directors. It's owned by a very credible, very wealthy family that has relationships with all the important people. It has all kinds of interconnections with government officials, and there's kind of a revolving door between top-level Times people and the State Department and the Pentagon. Somebody like Leslie Gelb, for example, was their foreign editor, was in the State Department, then at the Times, then in the Pentagon, then in the Times, and they have as a big, powerful institution, they have symbiotic relationships with the government and with advertisers and advertising business, with their bankers, and they're under constant pressure to see the truth of the establishment view, and they acknowledge that they are members of the establishment. So on all the issues that are really important to the national establishment, the Times lines up as would be expected of an establishment institution. For example, on free trade, on the North American Free Trade Agreement, World Trade Organization, the protests against those, the Times always was on the side of the business establishment. And if you take practically all to the Cold War, the arms race, all through the period of the big arms buildup in the 80s, the Times was supporting that arms race in its own little way. Even the Vietnam War, where it's reputed that the Times, in fact, the conservatives argue that the Times and the rest of the media were adversary and hostile to that war and other wars, and helped lose the war. This is baloney. The New York Times actively supported the war up through the early 60s. And then
the Vietnam War.
The Vietnam War. But then from 65, 66 onward, they were sort of in favor of negotiations, but they never could penetrate through to see what the Johnson administration was doing. So we would have a peace move and stop bombing and say, look, we're ready to negotiate. But meanwhile, they would tell the Vietnamese, you have to surrender. That's really the term. So the Vietnamese, of course, didn't do anything. But the New York Times never penetrated that veil. They always said, oh, look, we're offering a peace move, and the Vietnamese are not taking it. So what more can we do but bomb? I have this discussed. There's a whole chapter in that book on the Vietnam War, the New York Times coverage there, and in all the critical phases of that war, the Times, in the end, would give the war a boost. There were demonstration elections in 1966 and 67. And these, the Pentagon Papers admits that these, that the peace moves and that the these elections were done simply to pacify the American public, but that the New York Times took those elections just as these, the phony peace moves, they took them seriously, and they really argued, well, this should help bring peace, when in fact the function of the elections was to quiet the American public so that the war could go on, which it did. Same thing, the same thing was true, incidentally, in El Salvador, where we had elections that we sponsored in 82 and 84, and they were clearly to clear the ground for more war, because there were no peace options on the agenda. The New York Times swallowed that, and they helped, therefore, perpetrate the war.
You know, I have to tell you, Edward, one of my favorite quotes from Manufacturing Consent is, propaganda is to democracy what violence is to totalitarianism.
Yeah.
And the New York Times, in what you're arguing, is essentially a propaganda outlet for U.S. policy over decades.
That's right. It's not always just a propaganda outlet. It does deviate somewhat on tactical issues, and sometimes on some points there's a disagreement. But when push comes to shove on the big issues, they are right there pushing the establishment line. My favorite quote from Manufacturing Consent, I can't give it exactly, but in the midst of the Vietnam War, James Reston, the principal main New York reporter, said that we're in Vietnam to establish the principle that you cannot achieve political change by the use of armed force. He was saying that we, who were using armed force and who constantly admitted that we, our side had no indigenous political support, he's saying that somehow or other it's the Vietnamese resistors who were using armed force to try to achieve their political end, not we who were there from 10,000 miles away to impose a government by force. I mean, that is the most Orwellian statement that I think I've ever encountered.
Right, and it was in self-defense, of course, that U.S. soldiers...
self-defense. Well, in defense of self-determination, yes, by a people who didn't want us and who we from time to time would admit didn't want us, but nevertheless, we were there to help them get democracy, self-determination, I mean, straight Orwell.
One thing I want to kind of talk about is the difference between looking at individuals like Keller in an institutional analysis. And it's one thing that's clear to me in Keller's comments is that he takes the critique of the left as where the New York Times is basically a tool for Bush or the administration. And I gather the left's critique in general, and when I use the left, I mean generally speaking, that it's much more than personalities. It's a structural arrangement. The fact that the flow of information in a capitalist structure demands certain restraints.
Yeah, well, we get back to that question of structure and what the role of the New York Times is, and I certainly agree with you on the question. It's not personalities, although occasionally there's some important personality that can in. But the reason why personalities are not very important is this, that how people move through the organization is a function of how well they adapt to what the institution wants. So you have a guy like, I forget his name, the reporter in the New York Times in El Salvador. Do you remember his name?
No.
What the hell is his name? Anyway, there was a very good reporter in Central America. I'll think of his name in a minute. In the early 80s, but he was criticizing the Salvadoran army and giving very nasty reports, you know, about what they were doing. And there was a lot of pressure on the Times. And eventually, he was ousted. And the guys who played the party line moved ahead very nicely. But this guy was ousted. And you can find this all frequently in the New York Times. And a guy named David Binder was a very good reporter in the Balkans, But he did not follow the party line there. He thought it was a complex situation. It wasn't just the Serbs trying to create a greater Serbia and all the guys, the good guys being aggressed against. He knew something, and he did not get on the bandwagon of the party line. So he was gradually shunted aside, and only the people who would follow the party line. And so the whole movement through the structure, promotion, demotion, assignment, is a function of how you meet the political standards that are built into the structure and imposed by the proprietors. That's the way it works.
So it's internalization of values of looking at the world.
That's right. You have to internalize the values, or if you don't believe them to begin with, or you have to
fake it.
You have to make your compromises and just in a squeeze in odds and ends of dissent when you can do it without harm to yourself.
So I think you're telling me that I'm not going to be the chief editor at the New York Times.
Right. Also, it's really tough to deal with people who want to go into journalism and they ask you, you know, about how you can, what one recommends there. And if people are really critical and on the left, I have to tell them that they're in for a tough road because the compromises will be severe unless you line up with an organization that is a dissenting organization, usually a nonprofit, where you won't be making a hell of a lot of money.
Edward, I'd like to go back.
In indie media, for example.
Oh, okay. Edward?
Yes.
You okay?
I'm fine.
Indie media, for example.
Yes, indie media, for example, is a place where maybe you won't get rich if you want to go into journalism.
I want to go back quickly to Iraq, and I want to quote Keller one more time.
Yeah.
He says, the principal debate that led to the war was not over whether Iraq had something, but whether that something constituted a threat justifying invasion, or on the other hand, whether it be investigated and detained without the use of force. And he says, that debate, the real debate, was aggressively and skeptically reported in my paper and throughout the mainstream media. The reason the U.S. invaded Iraq was not because the media failed in its reporting. It was because the Bush administration had convinced itself that this was the thing to do.
Well, again, he's I think, misreading the facts of the case and getting himself off the hook. If his paper supported the Bush administration, one of the key facts in the world that bears on this is that a vast number of American people still think that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and that he had ties to al-Qaeda. Now, if the media as a whole had been doing a serious job when Bush was making these claims, and they were all extremely easily refutable, he didn't give any evidence for it, and there was a lot of counter-evidence, if the media had done their job, the public would not believe these lies. And the Bush administration would have faced a heck of a lot more of problems. The Democrats might have had their back strengthened to resist. The public, there may have been more people out in marches. And the media played a very important role in making the public accept the war and made a lot of people apathetic. If the media had done the proper job that they're supposed to be doing in a democracy, that the opposition to the war would have been far greater, and it would have been harder to go to war. So basically, he's again telling a big lie.
Yeah. And what's it going to take for people to not only have the information that's accurate, but really kind of wake up and challenge this stuff?
Well, it's hard to be optimistic on that front right now because the Bush won the election, and the Democrats are resisting extremely poorly. They're really doing almost nothing in the way of opposing his Iraq policy and his militarization policy. And the media are kowtowing to this power. And he has going for him, too, the fact that the media are more concentrated. The right-wing media is stronger now than ever, and it has an echo chamber that is extremely powerful, and so the so-called liberal media, which are not very liberal, are cowed by the right-wing media. This is part of the New York Times' problem, and the problem most of the centrist papers that we have. So it's a bad scene. We're behind the eight ball. It's very hard for us to reach out to the public. So if you ask, well, how can you forecast a more decent future? I'm afraid one thing that'll have to happen is that people are going to have to suffer more. I mean, I think that their eyes are going to have to be open by more unpleasant things happening. I'm almost pleased to see Bush going after Social Security. He's creating a lot more enemies. He's going to probably lose this battle. But I think people have to suffer more. I'm anxious to see gasoline prices go up a lot because that's going to put more pressure on people. And the one facet then is I think that people have to become more alienated. I mean, ordinary people have to be hit hard enough to open their eyes on who it is that's giving them the going over. The other side of the coin is that we have to develop our own media. I think that indie media is important. We have to, the mainstream media, I think, is beyond repair. I do love outfits like Fair and others who go after them and even alert us to their weaknesses. But reforming the existing media is very tough. You notice that PBS is even under immediate attack right now by the right wing, trying to make it even more centrist or more right-oriented. So somehow or other, we have to find funds or get organizations to put up an alternative media that will reach out to people. The trade unions have to start to do more in the way of communicating. We all have to be working harder to create alternative media. Here's where the Internet could be important. The Internet is relatively cheap. It has a tough time reaching out, but we have to find ways to use this relatively cheap medium to reach out to more people.
Edward, I'm sorry we've run out of time, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Indie Media On Air. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
It's good to be on. Thank you.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Edward Herman, Professor Emeritus at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania and a regular contributor to Z Magazine, economist and media critic. We are going to be joined by two student activists shortly, and we're going to talk more about the events surrounding the recent protests in Pomona and student activism in general.
On May 17th, the people of Los Angeles will have an opportunity to elect a new mayor. So register to vote and make a difference. The deadline for voter registration is May 2nd, and your registration must be current to participate in these very important and historic elections. That's the 2005 City of Los Angeles Mayor's Race. The deadline for voter registration is May 2nd. For more information, visit us online at www.kpfk.org or dial 1-800-345-VOTE.
All right, welcome back to Indie Media On Air. And to continue our discussion, we're going to be joined with Ryan and Assad. Assad is at Penn State, and he recently wrote an article on ZNet, and it talks a lot about student activism. And Ryan is a recent graduate of Pomona College and was at the protest actions against Bill Keller on Friday. Welcome to Indie Media On Air, Ryan and Assad.
How you doing?
Good. How are you guys doing?
All right.
Who is this? Who am I speaking to?
This is Ryan.
Ryan?
Ryan.
What's up, Ryan?
All right. I'd like to start by saying greetings and salutations to everyone out there on any media, Rethinking Alternative Nation. How you doing? This is Sean speaking with Chris.
Yeah, this is Chris.
All right.
So, hey, why don't we start with you? Why don't we start with you, Ryan? Tell us what happened on Friday.
It was sort of a shock in a lot of ways. I mean, I walked on campus, and it was a very, even on Pomona's tiny boat, there's still a very select few people who were actually actively invited to this event. But even on campus, who even knew about it, there's professors who I talked to, very prominent, very respectful, very, very critical, and, you know, progressive professors, didn't know about this. And this is something that they should have. And so majority of the people that we were interacting with were alumni. And it was interesting to see, like, depending on their reaction, depending on, you know, their actual opinions about foreign policy and just Keller's role in it. I mean, it depends on which generation you ask. Everybody had different perspectives. Of course, a few people that we talked to around his age group, we actually spoke to a group of men who were, you know, probably part of his, like, inner circle or entourage. I mean, these were his peers.
Right.
Defended Keller, of course. And another familiar action, an older woman, I believe she was an alumni from the 40s, and she was like, oh, don't be so hard on old poor Bill. And I was like, excuse me? And she ignored my question, and she sort of just walked off. I mean, it was very interesting. It was very interesting.
Well, let me ask you this. What drove you out there to protest Bill Keller?
Well, I'm an alumni, you know, and I'm part of this institution. And Keller is definitely, fully represents what, you know, how the conservative administration is pervasive and is completely interwoven into that of the, you know, the academic system. I mean, Keller, proprietor news media in New York, right? New York Times. He's an alumni of the same school, and they put him up on a pedestal and award him for his professional and academic success and professionalism. But what is he really doing? I mean, regardless of the fact, I mean, he supported the war. I mean, that's one thing that people ask, what did he do wrong? Isn't that enough? Especially given the power and influence you have over a major, you know, media outlet.
I heard that he was pretty surprised to be protested.
Yeah, it seemed like he was, even though you wouldn't think that, right? I mean, there's a lot of people that are upset for different reasons. During the course of his keynote speech, he took the perspective of someone defending himself from other conservatives. So our perspective was something that, you know, he gave acknowledgement at near the end, because it's completely different than the criticism that he was expecting coming back to Pomona.
Assad, are you with us?
Yeah.
Assad, you are at Penn State, and you recently wrote an article in ZNet talking about student activism. Why don't you give us a sort of a breakdown of what you were talking about?
Right. Well, mainly I'm taking this approach that
in the context of this discussion with, you know, the issues of propaganda of the New York Times, et cetera.
Well, as Edward Herman already demonstrated in a lot of detail, the war in Iraq was based entirely on false pretenses, which were communicated largely through the media. And an important second way in which this sort of securing of consent for American foreign policy takes place is what happens in the university. Because the fact that there was so little information widely disseminated about the war, the fact that so many people still believe, for example, that some of the hijackers on September 11th were Iraqis, or that people believe that Saddam Hussein really did have weapons of mass destruction, that is really a crisis in the educational system. Because education, since the Enlightenment, since the whole idea of having universities and having public education, has been about training people to become active, participating citizens, about providing a space in which we can collectively come to understand our role in society and to practice the means of debate and discussion that are the lifeblood of a democracy. But instead, we've found that two tendencies have prevented this from taking place in the university, which are both the corporatization and the militarization of education. And we know, as Edward Herman and his work with Noam Chomsky and others has demonstrated, that American foreign policy is increasingly market-driven, that it's based on securing natural resources and based on strategic maneuvering in the global economy and global politics. And the same kind of market politics of neoliberalism has increasingly taken over the university, in that the university is now, instead of preparing us to become citizens, prepares us to become workers in an increasingly alienated workforce and training us to become consumers. And you find this very clearly if you look at we have CEOs now becoming presidents of universities. Corporations are sponsoring chairs, things like that. Second, the militarization of the university has taken place because dissent is increasingly being crushed. You see with Ward Churchill, Joseph Massad, the whole crisis in Colombia, a lot of different universities have been crushing dissent at a really high level, which prevents students from being able to really participate in the open space that the university is supposed to provide of political debate. And so instead of open political debate, we have the same kind of ideological illusions propagated that are exactly what prevent people from questioning American foreign policy. The idea that American aggression is always somehow benevolent, that the entire history of American imperialism has been one of humanitarian intervention. We have the idea that the tyranny of the transnational corporation and international finance is development, you know, and extending the free market to the rest of the world. We have the complete objectification of the entire Arab world and the Islamic world. Instead of understanding the history of the Arab world, which is a rich and disparate one of scientific achievement, not just of Islam, but also of feminism, nationalism, revolution, it's all objectified and rendered into this very one-dimensional sort of caricature of Arab terrorism, Islamic fundamentalism. And without the understanding that this kind of history can give us, this kind of real political debate can give us, we are completely subject to the decisions of the corporate class.
Well, certainly there's a lot of student activism going on. I understand that there's a lot of attempts to silence it. And I mean, as we've seen just even recently, this protest on Friday, I think it's important because it really illustrates a direct challenge to what Herman articulated as propaganda within the institution. And and Ryan, why don't you give us a sense of what the messaging was on the campus? I mean, were you able to reach other students with what you were doing?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things, a lot of different organizations, a lot of in circles, a lot of individuals who came out in the course of last year, representative of, I think, all four classes, and different schools. I mean, the Claremont community is very unique in that they have five different, nucleuses, five different schools, and each having its own personality, and each having sort of like a larger generalized reaction to it. I mean, Pomona initially reacted very coldly. They were frustrated. They really didn't know what to do. And that's exactly what you would expect from a school made up of just really socially inept, you know, children of the ruling class, essentially. I mean, these people, before coming to Pomona, have never had an experience this diverse. They're completely just white privilege.
What happened last year?
A lot of things happened.
That you're referring to?
Right. That not necessarily were unique for that year. I remember each person can tell you, you know, right, regardless of the generation, how some terrible things actually happened at those schools sometimes, and they were pushed under the rug. I mean, but for instance, the last year, a lot of people, you know, remember distinctly, like, a definite incline in just the racial intolerance and just the conflict, the inner tension on campus after people realize that after a cross was burned at one of our sister schools, which is Harvey Mudd, a group of students, you know, were in themselves were a collage of you know athletes from different campuses, you know, in the Claremont Consortium. Took it upon themselves one night to burn a cross, which was an art project that they stole illegally, which was, you know, stored away and hidden, you know, for storage purposes because it was an art project given, done by an international student who wasn't there on campus. And that was something that immediately the administration tried to suppress. I mean, initially we didn't actually find out about the incident, the cross burning, to a month, close to a month after it actually happened. I mean, administration main excuse was that the given just the awkward schedule and just people coming back from winter break, there are reasons for why they needed to handle the situation to a certain extent before they were able to allow the wider population to know about it.
Right. Ryan, I want to jump in here real quick because I want to have the audience join us in this discussion and to call the station at 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. Go ahead, Ryan.
But yeah, and things sort of went up from there. One of the main problems, you know, that we all experience in activizing for social justice is just getting over the compartmentalization, the ability to actually collaborate and build coalitions that are lasting among different communities, and that happens sort of instinctually, even sometimes out of conflict, because so many different groups felt objectified and targeted back to back, week after week, for the course of a few months between when the crosses were burned and when the incident with Carrie Dunn happened. A professor at one of our other sister schools, Claremont McKenna College, who claimed initially that her car was vandalized by some unseen culprits. All kinds of racial epitaphs, sexist epitaphs, homophobic things were spray painted. The car was brutally vandalized. And weeks later, the FBI, after digging into the case itself, uncovered that she had apparently done it herself. That it was a hoax.
I heard about that story.
Right.
Right.
And the student activism that had sort of like that exploded after the initial event, the emotional outpour and just that the reactive response was something that was unprecedented, you know, on these campuses, that so many people felt an active obligation to these issues and to speak out and to be expressive, and classes were canceled the day after, for instance, the Carrie Dunn situation, and that happened through the hard work of students, mostly seniors on the, you know, who were representative of the Claremont, you know, community, people who had been working, you know, for a long time, and this is something that meant immediate acknowledgement.
I want to just ask Asad another question, and then we're going to go to some phone calls. Mm-hmm. And so people can call in at 818-985-5735. Asad, can you give us some examples of some of the organizing that your community is doing in regards to these issues that you were talking about earlier?
Right. That's a rather tragic question, because there's been precious little organizing around Penn State. There was quite a lot of activism about 2 years ago, right when the war was about to start. And at that point, Penn State had the largest walkout, at least one of the largest walkouts in the country, right before the war was about to start. There was a national walkout organized. And The one here was pictured on the BBC, widely reported, an extremely successful event. Then after the war started, there was a first level of demoralization, something of a downturn in activism. And now, after the election really diverted a lot of energy into, you know, doing voter registration, that kind of thing. And after that was finished and Bush won, there was an almost total demoralization, and there's very little activism here anymore. And most of it is being done by things like Amnesty International. When the week of campus resistance was announced, it was supposed to be a sort of national event, maybe on the scale of the walkout 2 years ago, but there were maybe, on the website, maybe 30, 40 events listed. It was once again something of a disappointment. There's been a real downturn in student activism, and which is, again, a real shame because the role of students is so central in both fortifying the system and resisting it.
We're going to take a call from Claire. Claire, welcome to Indie Media On Air. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I was at the speech that Bill Keller made. I'm a Pona alum, class of 83. I was there, and I asked the first question, which was about the war in Iraq, and I asked Bill Keller if they were going to make the same errors they made in terms of the drumbeat that they made for Iraq, if they were going to do it in Iran and Syria. And Bill Keller said they were going to be much more circumspect. But the last question that I asked was about a lady before me asked about the September 11th attacks. It was apparent to everyone in the audience. Bill Keller said that the narrative of the September 11th attacks, the official narrative, was fine, which was kind of stunning to a lot of people in the audience. But what I would have to say is Bill Keller just lied through his teeth throughout the whole thing. One is a really good school. Most of the people in the audience were probably in their 60s and 70s, 50s, 60s and 70s. They were too old to have protested Vietnam. Maybe they did. But Bill Keller sat there, and he just spewed lies throughout the whole thing. And I have no faith in the New York Times at all. He will continue to spew lies. When he was asked about very specific questions, he just lied.
What was your sense of the response in the room? People just weren't very critical of him.
When he gave the speech, he was pretty much he was kind of applauded. But then during the town hall meeting, which happened after that, about an hour after that, it was much more critical. So I'm not sure. But I left the symposium, which had journalists from all sorts of different publications, like Esquire and the Chicago Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, Wired, the National Journal, Associated Press. I left it thinking that the press does not know anything, and left it with much more of an appreciation of KPFK. And
Claire, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut you off because we only have a minute left. And I want to give our guest, Ryan and Assad, a chance to maybe give a website out. Do you have any information where people can follow up on this, Assad or Ryan?
One website is campusresistance.org, which it was for the week of campus resistance, and it's going to continue into the future to be used as a way for campus groups to organize and to have a little dialogue. And otherwise, you can take a look at my article, Seven Theses on the Anti-War Movement and Student Resistance, on ZNet and elsewhere.
That's zmag.org.
Right. And it's also on Left Hook, some other places. And Left Hook, ZNet, great resources for anything.
Campusresistance.org. Ryan, do you have any sites or phone numbers or anything that you want to give to people?
Yeah, I'd like to give a shout-out to the Student Liberation and Action Movement of the Claremont Colleges, and they have a Yahoo's group where you can, you know, asked for articles to be submitted and, you know, post your comments and concerns. Yeah, so the Student Liberation and Action Movement, that's SLAM, S-L-A-M.
Okay, thank you very much. Today's show is produced by Alan Minsky, Scott Radigan, and Alice Taylor, and engineered by Maggie LaPique. Thanks to our guests today, Edward Herman, Ryan Johnson, and Assad Haider. Ryan, post that on la.indymedia.org and people can read about it.
All right.
All right, thanks so much, you guys, for joining us today.
You've been listening to Indie Media On Air, heard Monday afternoons from 3 to 4 on community-based KPFK, 90.7 FM LA, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and throughout the world at kpfk.org. The Voice from the Frontline edition of the 4 o'clock report is coming up next. Stay with us.